The season finale of Wayward Pines is over, but we are just getting started here at Poster Recaps. Hello, everyone. My name is Mike Bloom, and I am joined by someone that I just woke up cryogenically to podcast about this show for me. It is the one and only AJ Mass. AJ, I know you're a little discombobulated right now, but you look very good in that gray jumpsuit, I must say.
Oh, wait, thank you. Is this a hospital? Wait, what's going on?
Yes, it's a hospital. Don't worry. They're listening. But they're supposed to be listening because they subscribe to this podcast. So we should buy into their listening.
Oh, okay. Well, then all must be well then.
So here we are, AJ. Several months ago, you and I started podcasting, talking about the first two episodes of this season. Here we are several weeks later at the very end. Kirk Clark, unfortunately, could not be joining us. He was not woken up. The first generation decided to keep him still frozen, but he helped us guide our way through this entire season/series. Now we're at the end of it. I have no idea what the prognosis is or forecast is for a second season. I know there were inklings of talk about it, but those seem to have disappeared. So for all intents and purposes, let's refer to this as the series finale. We're obviously going to dive into a much more detailed take on the episode, but AJ, I would love your take generally. What did you think about this final episode?
I thought it was pretty good in terms of wrapping up everything that had been set up. I think that as a complete unit and this being a series finale, I think I am fine with it. It's not like some series finales where you go, wait, there's still 73,000 questions you didn't answer. I don't expect any show to answer every question, but I feel that these 10 episodes had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I think that's what's important. It feels complete to me. So in that sense, as a final episode, it's a success.
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed this episode. And I know we've had our gripes about some of these middle episodes, but I talked about at the end of the last podcast that I was really excited to see, you know, the Abbeys being released into the town and David Pilcher really coming into his role as the true villain of the series. And so to have all these events play out, while it is a completely different show from what we first podcasted about a few months ago, it was a really exciting hour of television for me. And I do want to start by talking about the ending. I don't want to bury the lead here because maybe I should have reserved the does this feel like the end of an episode of Black Mirror question for this episode instead of the previous episode, because this was totally like a Twilight Zone-esque dystopia bleak ending. What was your take on this ending?
Yeah, the epilogue, if you will.
Yeah, yes.
I was fine up until the epilogue.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do not think that the epilogue was earned, and I do not think that it I don't think it made sense at all in the universe that they set up. And if it had just ended with all of the people from the town coming to safety and, you know, the truce between those who were in control and those who were under control and Pam and Kate and, you know, hey, let's do this together. Kumbaya. Yeah. If that had been the ending, I think that was very earned. This was so contrived to me. First of all, just the shot of Ben getting hit in the head was laughable. And for that to kind of be this kind of Dorothy waking up in Kansas moment, it seemed tacked on. Only 3 years had passed, and yet it was enough for the first generation to completely subdue the entire population and put them back in deep freeze, create their own town, learn metalsmithy and erect a statue to David Pilcher. I don't get that. And I didn't get the point of it other than a really cool echo of the first episode. I don't get the point of reckonings with signs that saying don't try to leave when if this is the first generation or the only people that are around, then why would anyone want to try to leave because they know the truth? I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that it definitely is holy. And not wholly in terms of a David Pilcher sanctimonious way, but wholly in terms of I think it does possess certain conflicts that may emerge the more you think about it. Maybe they were able to erect the statue because they took metal shop, which was presumably taught by Mrs. Fisher in the high school. That being said, I mean, just purely looking past those holes, I actually enjoyed the ending. Ben getting knocked out aside in probably the most goofy, like, Hanna-Barbera, Tom and Jerry cartoon-esque way possible. I just liked it because of its thematic connections. And you and I have talked about Black Mirror before, and I do have gotten more accustomed and more and have enjoyed more of these like very bleak, darker endings. I definitely feel like this was it. And I will disagree with you that like the whole like Pam and Kate, like let's rebuild the town thing, that to me felt a little contrived. I will agree that it might have been well earned, but to me it was like, I don't really, you know, even though these characters have only been through 10 episodes, I don't really see them saying like, well, time to put our hands in, gang, and let's make this town a rip-roaring success. So then to have this first generation, which had been hyped up and hyped up and hyped up as, like, the next vessels of David Pilcher, basically, to come about and take over this town, was, to me, really cool, just because it was something that had laid the breadcrumbs down ever since the truth was revealed in the middle of the season. And so to have that come to fruition was really great, just on a pure thematic level. And it's very reminiscent of, spoiler alert, the end of The Wire, which was very much like there's a whole montage at the end of certain characters, specifically like younger teenagers and, you know, people in their 20s, filling roles in society that were filled by other characters that had either died or vacated their positions, etc. And, you know, I love that idea of like, the world will just keep turning, even though different players are involved. The same play is still going on. So I love this idea of like Ben is now in the Ethan role, and now he's the one wandering through the town. And you know, I have no idea how they're running the town. It reminds me a little bit. I think there's a Netflix show called like Between, in which everyone who isn't between the ages of like 11 and 16 is dead. And so it's like, what happens when these preteens try to rule the world? And it might be a little like that. It's also interesting that like it's been like almost 4 years, and these people really haven't aged that much. I wouldn't say like go overboard with your aging makeup or anything. But that being said, I think just on the surface, for me, I thought it was like a fun ending, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later. I would love to brainstorm with you what a season two of Wayward Pines would look like, considering the ending of this one.
Yeah, that's fine. I hear what you're saying about I don't think that Pam and Kate would necessarily work together. I don't think that necessarily they were either of them was being truly 100% honest in their trust. But I think the fact that they would have said that made a lot of sense and rang true, even if, you know, they may not follow through on that and there would be problems, you know, in the future. So in terms of that ending, I didn't think it was much of a cheat. I think it just really comes down to an interview that I read with our good friend M. Night Shyamalan about how this show came to pass now that it's over. And he worked backwards from this ending. This was the ending he wanted.
Oh, interesting.
And he wrote the ending first, which is not the same ending that was in the book series, and decided to work backwards from it to get to the beginning. And that, you know, you do improv. I did improv for many years. That is possibly the worst way to construct a narrative that flows and raises the stakes along the way, because it's all about doing it backwards. And I think it really shows that you know, this tacked on ending feels very tacked on as a result.
So we're going to talk a lot about like the differences between the books and the show, because I know it's been brought up by a few listeners. And now that the show's over, I think we're in free territory right now. And obviously, spoilers for the books will be abound here. AJ, can you talk a little bit about what the endings was like in the book and how it differs from the show?
Well, see, I didn't read the books, but I've read a lot of stuff online about it. And apparently, the first book was essentially the first five episodes, with the big reveal of the truth at the end of book one. So there was that aspect to it. And then basically the next two books followed along the same course, except that Hessler, their boss from the old days in the Secret Service, survives that video in San Francisco. And a lot of the third book is him making his way back through Abbey territory back to Wayward Pines. And he comes back and he's kind of the big hero at the end of the book.
Interesting.
So since they pretty much scrapped that entire storyline, you know, they really needed to do things. You know, the electricity eventually does go out. The Abbeys come over the wall and kill the whole town and everything. That kind of pretty much played out the same way. Also in the books, Pam does not have a change of heart. Pam is that crazy Pam from the first few episodes throughout, and she's pretty much the big bad towards the end and going on the Messiah complex power trip. So a big difference in terms of who drives the plot.
Yeah, it seems like they're going to True Blood territory here in terms of discrepancies between the source material and the televised material.
Yeah, and I'm fine with changing the source material. I mean, if you have read the book, then it's surprising to you. Love it or hate it, and most people would probably hate it if they liked the book. I get that. I've been burned by source material adaptations, of course. We all have. But I do think that it seems to be more along the lines of, you know, which actors they could get and who they had cast and who they liked and a little bit of that playing into it as well. Plus, from what I understand, the Hessler's journey back to Wayward Pines from San Francisco would have been almost unfilmable, and certainly unfilmable from television with the budget they had.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was a shoestring budget, but yeah, for a budget for television, I think they got very lucky, or they were able to probably get a lot of people to buy into this by just saying, well, we're mostly going to film within one town anyway, and there will only be a few times we'll use the green screen. So to have these people, even though it'll be mostly in the forest, to have them traverse this, you know, the 40-28 environment would probably require some visual effects. But that would be interesting, because I think, from what I remember from us talking about throughout the season, we were thinking like, okay, that scene between Adam Hessler and David Pilcher, like, that's going to have repercussions, that Hessler's going to become a bigger character. And he appeared in that video last episode, but that was pretty much it. So I feel like that was some unmined territory that they definitely could have utilized.
Yeah, I think they just paid it lip service because it was in the book, and they were trying. Like I said, their intentions were to tie up as many loose ends as possible within the confines of these 10 episodes, and I think, like, for the most part, they did succeed in that. You know, they don't have to go into depth on every single, you know, path that they went on and every plot point you bring up. I mean, I'm still wondering why really they opened up with this, you know, him and the psychiatrist who never shows up again.
Yeah.
Like, that seems to me something that could have been mined a little bit more as well. But so be it. You know, it's not that big of a stretch because we did tie up the Easter bombings in some way, especially in this final episode. The irony of him using a bomb to save the day when it was a bomber who screwed up his life in the first place. Okay, I get it. Cute. Everything mirrored. There was a mirror there at the end, which was nice. But I do think there were a lot of lost opportunities in terms of what they could have done. That's not for me to say, though. You know, it's their story.
Yep.
They can tell it. Just because I might have done different things doesn't mean that I hate when you say, well, that's not how I would have done it, therefore it's bad. That's not it at all. I think they did a good job of tying up loose ends. I just don't necessarily think that the very tail end was earned, and that's my problem with the show in terms of, you know, how I'm going to place it in the pantheon of greatness, you know, going forward. That said, it was a fun 10 episodes. Even the ones I hated, I still enjoyed watching because it was, you know, you can have fun hating things.
Yeah, well, that being said, and we'll probably also give our general thoughts on the season near the end of the podcast here. I know there has been some misconstrued opinions from some of our listeners that they think, like, we outright hate the show. And I just want to say, personally, I did not hate this show whatsoever. I think if I really didn't like the show, I would not have come back after that first episode to come back and talk with you guys about it. I did have fun with the show. I mean, yes, there are things that I like to nitpick. And I'll be honest and I say I'm probably a very different individual in terms of the fact that I love to nitpick things from pieces of pop culture, and I have fun doing that. You know, I'm a big fan of really bad movies because you're able to pick apart any plot holes or bad performances or anything like that. So I apologize if it ever came across to anyone like I was outright hating the show, but it was a fun mystery for the first five episodes. The fifth episode was like a a bat poo insane type of reveal. The episode, and then it completely changed tones to a different type of thing, which wasn't necessarily bad, just different. And I would say even this final episode was different tonally from everything else, but I still had fun with it. It's a summer series. Look, it's not going to be revolutionary television, but I would definitely put it on the same level as some of the other, even shows like Revolution, you know, some of these like post-Lost mystery shows. I would definitely put this on the level with it. I don't think it's like an outright egregious bad skin mark on the summer series.
No, absolutely not. And you know, Twin Peaks is my favorite show of all time, and you're not going to find anyone out there who's going to nitpick the things that are wrong with Twin Peaks more than me. That doesn't mean I don't love it and think it's the greatest TV show of all time, because I do. But in terms of, like you said, that's a summer series. Look, I gave The Whispers a try. And within an episode and a half, I was just like, this is never going to be anything positive. I'm out. The Event was another one that was just like, okay, this just, the logic of these shows just falls in on itself and collapses. Like, I'm nitpicking this. There are certain things I wish had been done differently. There are certain decisions I just don't understand and I want to understand. But that said, I watched the whole thing. And, you know, that's... not a bad thing. And I want TV to show shows like this that are willing to take chances and throw a huge course change in episode 5. I want TV show that's going to do things that I haven't seen before. And even if you know, you throw everything at the wall and none of it sticks, fail miserably, that's great. Yeah. I don't want TV to be boring and formula, and I don't need another 16 new CSI, NCIS, Criminal Minds procedurals out there. Let's do something different. And so I'm happy that there are a lot of people out there who are passionate about the show and thought, hey, I really liked it. Great. I hope there's more like this. I don't necessarily need more of this, but more shows. The more shows, the better.
So let's start really diving into a dissection of this episode. So we start as we left the last episode with the Abbeys, the power shut off to the entire town, and Abbeys begin climbing over the wall. I do have a question as to, like, you know, they obviously show up as red dots on the map that David Pilcher and everyone else in the bunker has up. I'm trying to remember, have they tracked the Abbeys before and that's how they know where they're going to be, or is this just some sort of like approximation of where they think the Abbeys are going to?
I was going under the assumption that they still have satellite technology and this was some sort of heat signature they were picking up. That was the conceit I was going by, because no, it really doesn't make sense for them to know exactly. Nor does it really make sense for, you know, the electricity to go out. And yeah, okay, the electricity goes out. I understand the Abbeys that are within visual range of the wall might decide to climb over it. I don't know how that suddenly summons 5 million Abbeys from all over town to go, oh, the electricity's out.
Yeah, so. Well, it made me think for a second, which I thought might have been a cool twist, you talked about Adam Hessler making his way back to the town in the books. I was wondering if those red dots might have been other people. And I thought that could have possibly been a fun twist of, like, it's David Pilcher was possibly lying or just didn't realize that there were other people outside Wayward Pines and they were just making their way over into the town now that the electricity was out.
Absolutely. That was another way they could have gone, and it probably would have been equally as plausible and equally as loved/hated as the ending they chose. So, like I said, I don't care if you can justify your ending, even if it's not the one that I necessarily chose. Then go for it. And you're right; that totally would have been plausible, and I would have been fine with that too.
So the town basically goes into crisis mode at this point, and we'll get to the slaughter that occurs later on. But you know, they decide to split up and take, you know, go to the sheriff's station. But we have Ben in the hospital, and Amy wakes up, and basically Ben just sort of describes the situation of what's going on. He, you know, tells her, like, I was scared that you'd never wake up, and I was scared I'd never see you again. And, like, I mean, if we talk about something that may have been phoned in this season, unfortunately, I was not buying the Ben-Amy stuff, even to this point.
No, I mean, perhaps if they had a different actor in the role, we might have bought some of it. Ben, just for me, just wasn't bringing it. And any scene he was in, I was just like, can we just get over this, please?
Well, I think it's something that possibly could have been explored more again if there were more episodes, because the way it came across, at least, I mean, Ben was sort of stiff as always, but Amy almost came across as like a sex hound, where she is just like was like constantly pursuing Ben. And so to have him kind of reciprocate the feelings, I get it's like a meaningful moment for the character, but again, it just sort of came out of nowhere, but I want to go to the prison here, or the sheriff's station, AJ, because for all as much as we eulogized Jason the previous episode, he is not dead, despite having no medical care. He is just hobbling a little bit. It's merely a flesh wound. What did you think about Jason still being alive in this episode and the implications it had?
Oh, man. The implication is that Ethan's a horrible shot. Or maybe he's a great shot, because maybe he was aiming to not hit any vital organ. You know,
I would think so, because Ethan up... Well, they'll get to a certain point where Ethan and Kate just wipe out a bunch of guards, but I'm pretty sure Ethan's, like, goal when he was in the town was never to outright kill anyone. So I could actually see it where, like, he purposely missed Jason's heart so he could just, like, incapacitate him, not kill him.
Yeah, it's fine. The problem with the show, the main problem for me is, like you said, it's very rushed. The first five episodes really should have been like a 13-episode season. And this should really have been like an season four episode. So, we're trying to squeeze a lot of character development in where it didn't really belong and introduce characters. So killing him right off the bat probably didn't serve that ending at all. So, okay, fine.
Yeah, and it was interesting to just, I'm happy that they at least dropped in these couple scenes of him being in the sheriff's station, just so when everyone else came to break the kids out later on, we knew that he was still alive. But it was still like, it was almost like a Mikhail from Lost type of thing of like, how are you still alive? You just got shot. And they also just, it's weird that like also after shooting him, they didn't take him to the hospital. They just left him in a cell. Like, talk about negligence.
Yeah, except leave him there. They're probably waiting for Pam to show up, and they're like, "Yeah, we got this reckoning we got to do. Leave a message for Pam to come down and check it out a little bit later. But we got to go. We got to go to the town square."
Yeah, I gotta say, as much as we were kind of maligning the Ethan and the Rebel stuff the past few episodes, I actually was kind of happy to see them join forces. Specifically, seeing Ethan and Kate actually work together when they weren't. This is the first time in the series they basically weren't in opposition. And it makes for like more of an actiony type of show than we've seen before. But I thought this was a fun thing. Especially Kate finally gets to do something, which I was happy about, because she was such an interesting character when we first met her on the show, and obviously the history between her and Ethan. But she basically has really had nothing to do until this episode, when she's like, "Yeah, I'm just gonna kick ass and take names."
Well, we obviously learned that she wasn't that good of a toy salesman, because everyone that we saw go into the toy shop, she never actually sold anything to them.
Well, so, yeah, because they're all being used to make bombs.
Yeah, exactly. She certainly proved herself to be worthy of being pursued in the first place. This whole thing really started as like, we got these agents that are very important in the field that we have to track down. So I now see why she was someone important to track down.
Yeah. So let's go to the bunker here, which has, in my opinion, probably the strongest stuff of the episode. The strongest stuff for me is the David Pilcher and Pam stuff, just because that's another relationship that I feel like I wish we had really mined, just because there's a lot of complications there. She used to be a drug addict, and I'm assuming he feels a little bit like he's his sister's keeper. And we're finally seeing them. We saw them start to be in opposition a couple episodes ago when Pam was interviewing the employees to see like which one of them, lets things get away on the screen. But now that he's cut the power and he's kind of ascended to the full god status he thinks he is, I just love seeing these people in opposition to each other. And I love, David's plan is basically, I think as we assumed last episode, was he's going to make the Abbeys wipe everyone out, and then he's just going to make preparations for Group C. And sort of reflecting her ideals that she talked about a couple episodes ago, Pam talks about like these are people, not just ideas. And she finally stands up to him and says, "You are going too far." And in true action movie fashion, the big bad decides to, when his assistant turns on him, he sends her away.
Yeah, it was dramatically a very perfect moment in terms of, this whole town was portrayed as a new family, and this was the family behind the scenes that had always worked together, and to see how Pilcher's family that he had created in Wayward Pines was falling apart, at least, you know, to him, like, well, my family, my true family here behind the scenes is with me. And for him to have the betrayal from the one member of that family that actually was a blood relative, I think was the last domino to fall that pushed him completely over the edge.
Yeah. And I think it was that more meaningful. I mean, I know he got, again, built up to this sort of over the top cartoon-esque villain levels, but I think this is a necessary step in his ascension.
Yeah, you need to understand that he realizes that there is no going back. There is no taking the foot off the gas. And while you know, we all see that, you know, he's going too far and that these are people, because obviously the people of Wayward Pines are the people that we've been following. They're the ones that we've been identifying with. We know they're not just, you know, extras like, you know, half of the people who showed up in the last two episodes. But, like, you know, we've gotten to know some of these people. We know that they're their people, and Pam's lived among them. Clearly, she spent a lot more time there than Pilcher, and she's gotten build relationships, and they're not just an idea. They're not just an experiment. And Pilcher has always kept that distance, and he's able to remain cold and distant from them and can make these decisions, but it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy for him. It's like, no, we got more. We'll start again. It's fine. I got all these bodies. We'll keep going until we get it right. But, you know, what is right?
Yeah.
You know, Pam says, this is working. We've told them, and they're banding together. Look how they're fighting for each other and with each other, you know, to rally. And starting over.
Yeah, and it's really fun because my opinion of Pilcher has changed so many times during this series. You know, I'll admit, once the truth got revealed, I was like, oh, I can see where he's coming from. He wanted to, you know, he knew, he thought things were coming, and he wanted to build a perfect world. And then we started to see, like, oh, to him, a perfect world is a much different idea than what we consider a perfect world. His perfect world is basically him in charge and basically a bunch of, like, lab mice blindly stumbling into edges of a maze. So to have him really come into, like, oh, he is crazy, was a really fun sort of realization for me, at least. And it shows here in this next scene where they're still at the sheriff's station, and then Jason musters up the strength to sort of start monologuing about how, you know, Pilcher predicted the first, you know, you can fight all you want, but the first generation will rise up and inherit the earth, which ends up becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I do love that, like, having these two scenes echoing each other is just, like, a great sign of, like, how deeply reverberating Pilcher's messaging was.
Yes, and it worked. It's this function of indoctrination in the schools. I mean, there's so much political stuff going on here, too, but, you know, like, he's indoctrinated them through the schools. This is, you know, if this is all you know, and this is all that you ever hear, and this is all that you learn, you're not going to seek out any other answers and any other point of view that comes your way. You're just not going to accept it all. And so the people who were around and knew what life was like before, for them, they can't accept that this is the way, and we're not going to follow Pilcher blindly. Are you crazy? We know that that's not the way the world can be, and there's a definite line in the sand that cannot be crossed. And so it makes perfect sense that the first generation would behave the way they're behaving, and it makes perfect sense that the Wayward Pines residents would behave the way they're behaving. So in terms of setting up motivations, it totally rings true.
So let's talk about the cinematography in this next big scene, which is back from the commercial break. It's, you know, Pilcher puts on classical music, and underneath it is this montage of the Abbeys in slow motion basically infiltrating the city. I'll put the city in quotations because it's basically the main street plus a couple of other discrete locations. I thought this was a lot of fun, and I know we talked a little bit about the cinematography last episode with Jason, you know, deciding to shoot basically all the rebels except for Kate that were in the sheriff's station. So this was another one of those, like, these really kind of artistic, almost cinema-like scenes that, granted, sometimes in the cinema and with trailers, it can be a little stereotypical, but I still had a lot of fun seeing it in this episode.
Yeah, I thought the whole thing was done very well. You know, a lot of the characters who we had just known as person in the background getting eaten isn't going to have an emotional impact. But, you know, in terms of making it such this grandiose final last stand, you just know that this is not going to end well when all is said and done. It's just a question of which characters are going to survive the main onslaught. And to do it in such a operatic fashion, I think is fitting of a miniseries like this.
Were you happy to see the death of the pervy real estate guy? I forget his name.
I don't know his name on the show, but yes, Mike McShane going, that was delightful. I only wish that he had been singing an Irish drinking song while...
that was on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. It was all the characters that we had seen, you know, good old Arlene gets saved at the last minute, but hotel guy, he goes down. Some of the people that we've known don't survive, and you need that. You need some of the people that we've known to survive, and that was great. I had a slight problem with the fact that they had, talked up the Abbey so much that, like, you can't possibly defeat them, and there are so many of them, and yet it seemed like, you know what, I think you probably could defeat them fairly easily as long as you were armed.
They were taking out a lot of them very easily with the weapons. Maybe it was the way that, you know, Mrs. Fisher and David Pilcher were like indoctrinating the Abbeys into everyone was to make them have the assumption that they're not going to have weapons, since that will obviously breed, you know, some sort of unruliness within the town. But yeah, if you have a shotgun, you can mow down a bunch of these Abbeys, no problem.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's not a plot hole or anything, because, like I said, they didn't really spend a lot of time out there with the Abbey, so I'm sure that, you know, Mrs. Fisher was told this is what you teach them about the Abbeys, that they're horrible, horrible things that will kill you and there's no defense against them. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. So, I'm fine with the fact that, I could just happen to be stuck against one and be able to, use my whatever I find in the toy shop and bash its head in. Okay. Yeah,
the truth is that they're actually very, very weak creatures.
They're just hungry, that's all. They have sharp claws.
They're really hungry. So we go back to the bunker here, and Pam tries to, David Pilcher has said put her in suspension, and they've rounded up, I think, all the other employees, and they said, like, okay, you know, Pam tries to give this big rousing speech to both the employees and the guards about how, you know, we did succeed in producing the first generation. And, you know, my brother is not a god. He is just a man. And I just want to take this moment to talk about how fantastic Melissa Leo was on this show. I think at the beginning of this podcast, I definitely criticized her a little bit on her mustache twirliness of the way she played Pam, but what she transformed into once the truth was found out, and the way this character morphed into something completely different from what we saw in the beginning, was just a fantastic journey. And Melissa Leo, I mean, she's an Academy Award winning actress, so I felt like she played everything that she should, and really, she made this character come to life. This might be actually my favorite character of the entire series.
She's phenomenal. She was my favorite character at the beginning, and she was my favorite character at the end. And what can you say? Melissa Leo is phenomenal. Like I said last week, that I think part of that over-the-top nature of her character in the first few weeks, I just saw such depth to it that she was playing a woman who is used to putting on a performance. And, you know, in the town, she was playing a character. And the fact that it was so over the top was just the fact that Pam is not that good of an actress. And so Melissa Leo is a phenomenal actress playing someone who is not a good actress. And therefore her mustache twirling was actually even more brilliant when you look at it in retrospect.
Yeah. When you look back and if you want to rewatch the series, I think some things may fall by the wayside. I think there were some storylines that they put in there just for the sake of, like, creating the mystery that really doesn't pan out once you know the truth. But I do wonder if you look back and you watch Melissa Leo as Pam for the first five episodes, will you have that appreciation for, like, oh, she's clearly this woman that is trying to play this role and trying to be this silent enforcer, because that is a more nuanced type of thing that as a great actress, she was able to incorporate into her performance.
Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of it goes to shows like this, be it Lost or, you know, like let's take Lost for an example. And really us bringing up Lost, I've never had to see her on post show. But just, you know, think about how Locke is in the first few episodes. And does the actor, when he's filming the pilot, you know, does Terry O'Quinn know that Locke has been in the wheelchair, and is he, you know, does he know the entire character's backstory? I mean, looking back on it, the performance is even better because it fits. But you have to wonder, when do you tell the actor what their backstory is, if it's a secret, or if you haven't come up with it yet? And does knowing that backstory inform your choices as an actor early in a series, and does it hold up? And when it does, it makes those performances all the more magical to me.
Mm-hmm. Fringe
was a perfect example. Fringe was a perfect example of a show where you had characters that were lost at sea the first season, that didn't know anything about their backstories, and their performances were just all over the map. And then once they they locked it down, then all of a sudden you saw different actors on the screen.
I will also say that the end of this speech, where Pam is tased in the middle of it, reminds me a lot of like Samuel L. Jackson in Deep Blue Sea, where he's trying to give this like this big pep speech of we all need to work together, and then a shark just comes out of the water and eats him.
One of the greatest movie deaths of all time.
I would say so. Definitely not one of the greatest movies of all time.
No. Just movie deaths. Yeah, no, that's true. It's the suddenness of, you know, she was selling this speech, and how many shows would have the troops, like, especially, you know we're wrapping up and coming to an end here. So, like, but Pam is right. No. You had enough zealots in the crowd that it kept any opposition down. I think that is much more realistic than the trope.
Yeah, including what turns out to be Chekhov's guard here, where he's like, I don't know, I kind of think she's right. Like, oh, shut up, I don't know, Thompson. But it turns out that Thompson is going to become a major factor like 10 minutes into the episode.
Yeah, or at least, until we have our time jump later on.
Yes, very poor Thompson. He worked so hard to get Pam out, only to probably either be killed or get put back under. So it's a tough life being Thompson. But it's not a tough life being these kids, as now that, you know, everyone's gone from the sheriff's station and everything is in pandemonium, this is the time that the first generation is able to swoop in and free the imprisoned boys, including Jason, and they are going to the Ark. And we'll find out later that the Ark is basically just a bunker within the school that has all of these supplies. And it speaks more, again, towards, like, they really were pushing this first generation thing. AJ, what did you think about the Ark as a concept?
I'm not surprised that it existed. It makes sense that it existed because everything was about protecting these kids, and no way, you can't go into school and snoop around because you might discover that secret room. So, you know, I'm cool with the fact that it exists. I didn't think it was one of these Deus Ex Machina things. I think the show earned this portion of it. You're allowed to have surprises for the audience. This one makes logical sense to me. Calling it the Ark, I think, was a little heavy-handed. There was a lot of religious allegory in here that I didn't think needed to be here, and that was just one more aspect of it. But okay, that's fine. I'll go with you.
Now, do we think that in the Wayward Pines of, 3 years and 4 months from now, do we think Jason's the leader? Is he the mayor or the David Pilcher or even the sheriff? Because it seems like, even though he's been introduced so late, it seems like he is the veritable leader of this first generation before everything happens.
Yeah, I think it looked to me like he was the sheriff of the town. So I think that's kind of, he seems to me to be the type of person who's going to be the one who enjoys having his reckonings and meting out justice, and perhaps, having the occasional French vanilla, Rocky Road, double scoop ice cream cone that all sheriffs are wont to do. But I think he's in charge of the justice, and I'm sure that there's some other high-ranking first-generation guy who they trust to be the mayor.
Yeah, though we find out, I mean, if it's anything like the generation before them, the mayor really doesn't matter, because even as Sheriff Pope says, it's his town. So it's basically the law rules this town. There's no government really is involved with this.
Yeah, I just don't necessarily think that the laws themselves make sense in a world where everybody knows the truth from the get-go, who can handle the truth from the get-go. That to me is a little bit odd. I get that maybe there are people who might not want to live under the iron thumb of that psychopath, and they're the ones who might try to leave. But really, where would they go? They know there's nowhere else to go.
Yeah, they'll be strung up on a telephone pole, apparently.
Yeah, okay. So my choice is have the crazy psycho sheriff kill me or get eaten by cannibalistic beasts. I think I'll stay here and at least try and avoid the sheriff as much as possible.
Yeah, I'll just hang out here. So this is Kate is by herself and she is back in the toy store. There's this one of these interesting scenes that I feel like the show actually might not have deserved here, where Kate like locked herself in the back room escaping an Abby, and she was like taking her time to like touch everything in the back room. If we had more Kate flashbacks and more episodes about like Kate and her husband and how she feels about her job, I feel like this would have been completely well deserved. But we just don't know her connection to her job and to the town enough to be like, wow, this is a really meaningful scene. The only thing I gleaned from this scene is basically the fact that an Abby falls through the roof and Kate basically brains the Abby with a toy that she finds.
Yeah, this again, I mean, I know that M. Night didn't direct this scene or direct this episode at all, but this was just, okay, suddenly we're back in Signs and there's an alien on the roof and she's braining the alien. I mean, this didn't really fit in the huge apocalypse that was going on all around town. To suddenly make it a quiet moment and a one-on-one battle, it seemed a little bit forced.
Yeah, though I will say this, the Abbeys are probably better supernatural creatures than the aliens from Signs, considering the aliens from Signs could not get through doors and were afraid of water.
Well, yes, because they were all related to the Wicked Witch of the West and would melt.
Whoa, you just blew my mind with that theory. So, well, yada yada a little bit. Ethan helps take out an Abby that snuck its way into the hospital and saves his family. And basically everyone who's left gets down to the bunker. And boy, Megan Fisher gets served a slice of humble pie here, where even Ben, who she may have hypnotized, we still don't know, basically turns against her and says, "You are wrong. David Pilcher is not coming to save us. He wanted to kill us all. We need to go find him and kill him."
Yeah, and I think this was an important scene in terms of, you know, just reinforcing the point that Mrs. Fisher is just completely brainwashed herself. And people who are so reliant on an idea being true, and it becomes their entire reason for living, and they base their entire world's philosophy around this one idea, when it is directly shown to be a lie, they still nevertheless will hold on to it, because to not do so would be to admit that they have been fools. And she would rather say, no, I still believe in David Pilcher, than to admit, oh crap, the Abbeys are coming to kill me.
Yeah, though at least, you know, if Teresa Slapp didn't get the you know, slap her back to her senses, I guess Ben's words did, and she just decides to finally fess up to them, like, look, here's the way you get from the barracks into the mountain complex, which, again, for as conspicuous as the wooden shack, you know, may be, and the bunker and everything, it is weird that it's a direct line to the elevator itself, that there's not some sort of, like, barriers in between them.
Yeah. But again, this is time saving in the course of, like, we don't have much time left for the show. I mean, there was a lot of that going on there. The why that whole bunker would be in the center of town in the first place doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, how she says to them, "Oh yeah, and I know the password for the elevator," but she doesn't actually. We never actually see her tell them the password,
yeah,
and she doesn't actually go with them to the elevator. So it's like, I guess she told them.
No, I was suspicious that Megan was going to mislead them, because she still thought that David Pilcher was still going to protect them. I mean, she was definitely an odd duck through and through, which even culminates in her deciding to like leave her husband and stay behind, hopeful that the first generation will come to her, only for Abby's to come and presumably tear her face off. But I mean, it was an interestingly performed role, and it's still something that I still can't kind of take a grasp of. And maybe that's another role that would require more flashback scenes, especially I would love to see this woman's life before she decides to join the cause.
Yeah, I think we needed a lot more. I think this was 10 episodes, and while that was probably at the edge of my patience for sticking with it at this clip, like I said, this seemed to me, this last episode really was the last three episodes of a season four for me. And you know, we're squeezing this all into 10 episodes, so it's really hard to really get to know all of these characters and all their motivations and to come up with some sort of, you know, oh my gosh, that's right. Cause I remember, you know, in season two, episode seven, she had that story, you know, there isn't a lot of that there. So, you know, it's quick.
Let's talk about these couple of scenes that follow that are basically like, you know, mend fences scenes. There's one between Kate and Teresa, and there's one between Ethan and Ben, and they're very different circumstances. Obviously there is a very different set of circumstances behind both of those relationships, but they presumably have the sort of the same outcome, which is they decide like, okay, any conflict we had before is water under the bridge, and we're gonna move on from this. Do you have any strong takes on either one of those scenes?
I think certainly the one with Teresa and Kate was earned. I mean, they're grown-ups, and they've come to understand everything that's happened in this town, and I think there's a little bit more, since Ethan has come clean, as to why the affair took place, and so I think she's absolved Kate of the guilt in that one a little bit, and so when they say, look, let's just, you know, bend the fence, she's okay with it. You know, Ben and Ethan, I mean, they're father and son. Of course there's not going to be that big of a rift. I mean, he didn't really do anything horrible. As Ben himself put it, sorry, I said some stuff.
Yeah, and even Ethan, when he said the stuff, said, like, no, you were right. Like, I should have, you know, prevented stuff. But, yeah, there wasn't much for them to make up between them. But I'm glad they really haven't had too many scenes together the past few episodes. So I'm happy they had a few scenes, at least this episode, and there was sort of the thematic stuff here about how Ben is sort of coming into his own here. You know, he has the gun. I think he has a better trajectory than Carl Grimes at this point, I would say.
Well, you know, at least he didn't put on his father's hat.
Not yet. You never. If Ethan had a hat, I'm assuming Ben would have woken up with that hat on.
Yeah, he may be walking a mile in his shoes at the end of the episode, but no hat. Just get brained by a bit of the debris caused by his father's.
Yeah, which was still like we needed like a boing at the end of it because it was such like a little klutzy thing to do. But let's not jump the gun here. Let's get to the elevator where they put the passcode in, and Ethan and Kate volunteer to go up first and scout things out. Meanwhile, Pam is officially being put in suspension. It was not as I guessed last week, being buried alive. Probably too dark on my part there. But this is when we get the full limit of like David Pilcher being the emotionless person he's become, in terms of his sister looked at him with tears in her eyes as she's being buried. And, you know, even David Pilcher, maybe it's just because he has like a frog face, but he basically registers no emotion. And after it's done, he just turns around and walks away. And that's, again, a fun little symbol of like, this guy feels there's no turning back, but he has completely betrayed the one person that was closest to him to get what he wants.
Yeah. And that I mean, you need that kind of cold-heartedness for us to hate him even more. And so from that sense, it's the perfect reaction for him to have.
Yeah. So Ethan and Kate, they get to the top of the elevator, and these poor guards, I have to sympathize with the guards a little bit here, because there's one, for example, that's like drinking something, and then Ethan and Kate just come out, just start shooting everyone. It's very like, it's very much like they were in the Sylvester Stallone movie for a few minutes, because for all this talk of Ethan being like, I'm not going to kill this person, that's cruel, that's inhumane, they just wipe down all of these guards that probably had, you know, families or relationships of their own.
Yeah, and it's that kind of situation where, you know, for us, the viewer, rooting for the Wayward Pines townspeople, then the Abbeys are just these things that, you know, well, we have to kill them or else we will die. And to us, even though they're people, they serve the same role, these guards. They're just they're in the uniform, they're all as one, and they're the other. So it's fine for us to shoot them. We didn't know what their names were anyway, so it's cool.
I wish they could have pulled like the deleted scenes of Austin Powers 1 where it like cuts to their families finding out that the nameless guard has died. Not enough time. That'll come in season 5 of Wayward Pines.
Yes, exactly. Oy.
But Thompson has his moment here where the other guards run after just to, you know, investigate what's going on. And then he's like, turns around, he's like, go take her out of suspension right now. So Pam was put under for a grand total of maybe 5 minutes, which is really lucky.
Yeah, and thank goodness there's no sort of long-lasting effects that, you know, she can snap out of it immediately. No need to wake her up in a hospital and ease her into the world. Just,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it didn't take. The deep sleep didn't take just yet. It's okay.
Yeah, I mean, the technology for suspension anyway is questionable, considering that it's like you're not suspended in, like, a goo, which is like the usual science fiction things that will supply you with nutrients through over the years. This is just like sand. And yeah. I don't know the science of sand and its effects on the human body, but you would assume that like the body would degrade a little bit if it was just buried in sand.
You would think, but this is magic sand.
Yeah, super sand.
Yes.
So Ethan basically radios down like, okay, coast is clear, start bringing people up. And the first group of people, which is, I think, like the majority of the town, gets onto the elevator. Meanwhile, Megan gets devoured by the Abbeys. The Abbeys have somehow tracked them into the bunker, and they have infiltrated it. And Ben starts putting on his big boy pants here, and, you know, he says goodbye to Amy. And basically, with this episode or any action movies in general, if somebody says a heartfelt goodbye to somebody else, I'd say about 8 times out of 10, that person is going to die. So I definitely thought for a second, like, oh, no, Ben's definitely going to be ravaged here. But Ethan luckily comes back in time because Ben is kind of a crappy shooter, or at least he's given a bad weapon. And Ethan basically gets Ben, Teresa, and, like, a bunch of the other rebels, including and Mr. Fisher as well, onto the elevator.
Yeah, this whole thing was a little bit cheesy and a little bit, I mean, thank goodness they didn't have, you know, Megan Fisher opening up the door when she heard the knocking, thinking it was someone, and oh yeah. My goodness, it's thank goodness they didn't go that route. It was the Abbeys, and they burst in, so she wasn't to blame for this. It wasn't like, oh, we left the zealot back here and she's going to screw us over. So thank goodness they didn't go that route. I found it a little silly that they're waiting for the elevator. Come on, elevator. Come on, elevator. Come on,
yeah,
elevator.
I would
come
say
on, elevator. And then all of a sudden, Ethan's standing there. Ah, wait, no one saw the elevator open?
I would say if your tension is built around when an elevator comes, like, that is, if you show that to a bunch of New Yorkers, they're like, man, I hear that. That's the tension I get every day of my life.
Yeah, but you know, just suddenly, so Ethan's there. Ha ha! The elevator came, and everyone who was waiting for the elevator, nobody noticed that the elevator came, but that's okay.
I do also question, like, so the Abbeys, I guess, you know, they killed everyone else, so they were tracking down, they were able to track down these other people. How were they not able to track down the first generation then? Because they were roaming the streets as well, getting to the Ark.
Well, because we needed all of the first generation to survive for our surprise ending. I mean, I think it's that simple. It's just selective killing as only related to the plot.
It's just weird that, like, you know, we'll see Abbeys swarm the elevator shaft in a few minutes, but it just seems, like, weird that every Abbey that is alive now has decided, nope, we're going after these guys now. Screw everyone else that may be alive.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta kind of just, you know, close your eyes and hold your nose and just go, all right, you know, just like whenever there's, like, two of your favorite Walking Dead characters who are being infiltrated by zombies, all of a sudden, that's when the rock falls and they all turn and walk the other way. Like, okay, I get it. It's TV.
So let's talk about the elevator stuff, because this is going to be the focus of a lot of action in the next several minutes. The elevator stops. Luckily, like, there's no one pregnant there. They'll have to give birth in the elevator, because that's the main source of elevator tension on television. But basically, they say, okay, you know, the Abbeys must have, I don't know, clawed through the cords or something to make the elevator stop. So they start going through the roof of the elevator. This Teresa and Ethan kiss to me was one of those, like, tinges of, like, oh nope, he's not gonna survive. And maybe that was the first moment I realized, like, oh, Ethan's totally gonna sacrifice himself. But the way he said goodbye to his wife and son was totally, I totally knew something was up. And I don't know if the characters were supposed to know that something was up.
Yeah, we've already proven that the characters themselves are not the brightest bulbs, so I'm fine with them not picking up on the subtle signs. But as a TV viewer, yeah, I mean, you know, thank goodness that the elevator wasn't possessed by the devil, because it's an M. Night production, so I thought maybe that was going to happen. He's like, I'm going to get all my films in here somewhere.
Yeah, I'm going to make Easter eggs for every one of my movies.
Yes, it's time. I think it's time, Ben, that we shake hands.
Oh, no, the wind.
Yeah, it was a little bit on the nose. It was like, no, really, Ben, you go. I'll be right behind you. Don't worry. I'll be right there. Like, no, he won't.
Yeah, that was a little heavy-handed to me.
But fine. Okay, you know what? It was at least, like I said, having Ethan sacrifice himself makes sense. He was the first character we were introduced to in the series. It was his eyes that we're seeing the show with. And, you know, if the battle is between what will Pilcher do to sacrifice, what will he sacrifice to save mankind? Clearly not much, except the people, you know, themselves, so that he can remain in charge. Well, if Ethan's the good guy, then he will sacrifice himself so that the people can live. And so that is the difference between the two, so it certainly makes sense from a thematic point of view.
Let's talk about David a little bit, because this is the final scene with him. I guess the elevator is mic'd, because as Ethan is setting up the pipe bomb, David Pilcher just decides to start talking to him. And there's a lot of David Pilcher monologuing this back half of the season, and it definitely comes to fruition here when he talks about, you know, you shouldn't have told them the truth, Ethan. You know, now all the Abbeys are just going to get up and kill them all. Everything's useless. And meanwhile, Kate storms in. Ethan asks her beforehand to try to, you know, basically take out David. David, again, continues to monologue. I don't know if he's still talking to Ethan at this point or whether he shut off the intercom about how... I actually really like this latter half of the monologue about how he says that this town isn't about freedom. It's about preservation of mankind, which is such like a representation of the final episodes, I would say, once Ethan finds out the truth and he's all about, you know, do I reckon these rebels or do I be humane and spare them? And he clearly, David Pilcher sways much more to the side of preserving mankind than Ethan probably once thought he was. So this is like the big conflict that has been set up. This is the man of science versus man of faith of Wayward Pines. Though, of course, it ends up being more about freedom for now as Pam comes in and kills him. What did you think about Pam being the literal nail in David Pilcher's coffin?
Oh, I think it was perfectly justified. It was perfectly... It was the right person to do it.
So just like Raylan Givens, is Pam the Raylan Givens of of Wayward Pines now?
Yeah, pretty much. If Kate had done it, I don't think it would have meant nearly as much. I think this is the whole thing. It's what would you sacrifice? And Pam will sacrifice her family in order to save everybody else. And Ethan will sacrifice himself in order to save his family. And I think it's a perfect parallel.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. And it is interesting that, you know, David Pilcher probably thinks he's sacrificing his family for the greater good as well. It's just the greater good is inherently evil, objectively.
Yeah, well, if the greater good is, as so long as I continue to be able to sit here in this room and be HOH for the next, you know, 6 million years, then yeah, that's the greater good, I suppose.
Yeah, David Pilcher has a mean case of HOHitis, I would say.
Absolutely, absolutely. He started off with good intentions, but after a while, she's trying to backdoor everybody.
Speaking of which, we talked about, you know, the WP takeover last podcast. I feel like this is the ultimate WP takeover in that this time the house guests were taking over production. That they were literally storming the bunkers where everyone behind the scenes was housed.
Yeah, it's like, we will not be have nots any longer.
Yeah, exactly.
No more slots for us.
Oh, man, I can only imagine. I think they're... have been some Big Brother house guests that are on the same level of mental stability that they would go into production offices with a gun and just start blazing people down.
It would be interesting to see. Perhaps it would be the end of the show, though. So, this is the end of this show, so sure.
So let's talk about the death of Ethan here. Now, AJ, I think you alluded to it before, but did you feel that Ethan's sacrifice was well-deserved in terms of the way we've seen his character and, you know, his trajectory and everything?
I think so. I think even from the beginning, he was always concerned with others. He was never doing anything in terms of what's in it for me. It was always about his family. It was always about helping the other people, even when they didn't realize they needed help. I think that's much to his detriment, I think, a lot of times, more often than not. But he was the character who was going to be the one to protect this town. And he swore an oath to protect the people in this town. And if that means I'm going to have to kill myself, then so be it.
Yeah. I will say that, like, people were talking online, I've read before reviews of this episode, that, like, they're like, what a redemption arc for Ethan. To me, in spite of, like, the cheating that he did on his wife and all the other stuff he may have done outside of Wayward Pines, Ethan never came across as an inherently bad person to me. Again, in spite of the adultery. So I would not even call this, like, a redemption thing for Ethan to sacrifice himself and that he's vindicated. I just more take it like you said, like, he's the way he thinks for the greater good, and this is just a natural progression of that. I do like, him looking up and thinking about his wife and his son at the, you know, his son's birthday. That was them awkwardly standing in the middle of a park. I don't remember. I think in the flashback he got a phone call from work about something, but I can't remember if it connects to anything at all, whether it was the call about Kate missing or something like that. But I thought it was like a nice little touch. And the music during this was like Michael Giacchino-esque, if we're making another Lost reference, in terms of like very soft music over this big emotional moment. And it creates enough of a fireball to, I guess, wipe out all of the other Abbeys that were in the elevator shaft.
Right, but not do enough damage to the complex itself that's going to allow the rest of them in.
Yeah, exactly. Dislodges a tiny bit of debris that just knocks Ben on the head.
We're finally here, aren't we?
Yeah, so Ben sticks his head out. He calls out to his dad. I kept asking, like, put your head back in. He's obviously God. And then it's clear that the reason why he stuck his head and stood out there was because a piece of brick, I guess, that got blown up, fell down, whacked him on the head, and knocked him out. And they don't really address it just because there's only, like, one more scene. So I'm assuming Teresa ran to come find him afterwards, but man, that was goofy.
Like, look, I'm not a physicist or anything like that, but I don't think that would happen. If the explosion blew out downwards, then maybe the elevator itself would have been pushed up, but I don't think one brick would have, and the timing of it wouldn't have worked. But, I mean, what a stupid kid.
Yeah, I mean, we know that he is not the brightest bulb in the shed here, which is also, I am not that hopeful for Ben as the good guy in the new version of Wayward Pines, because
we'll get to it.
Is definitely the C-level of Ethan at best. But after, you know, Ben gets knocked down in the goofiest way possible, this is our big scene that we talked about a little bit before, where Kate and Pam are downstairs, and I don't know if they're downstairs or in the office, I forget. But they basically, you know, they talk about, Kate basically asks for beds and supplies, but, you know, basically she's actually asking for more information about everything. And so Pam takes her downstairs to where everyone else is frozen. Did you count how many, or could you get a rough count of how many people were in that room? Are we to assume that's the only room, that's the rest of the people that were frozen? Because it doesn't seem that many people were left.
Yeah, I was under the impression that there were enough that, you know, Group C could easily have become D, E, F, and G. I don't necessarily think that it's like, oh my gosh, we only have this many people and we're out. I thought it was a healthy enough number. That was my impression. It could be horribly wrong, but I don't think it matters in terms of, either you wake everybody up or you don't at this point. And I would think that they would probably, the next steps would be to slowly awake everybody one after the other. I think that would be the plan. Which again also makes the ending even all that more stupid.
I would assume that once they got the power back on and they cleaned up all the corpses for the town, I guess their next steps, I mean, let's play the guessing game here of what Pam and Kate's next steps were, because they have this scene where they kind of shake hands and they say, okay, let's work together to build this town without reckonings or violence or anything like that. So I guess they want to file back into the town and just continue trying to live a peaceful existence while slowly waking people up and revealing the truth to them.
I would think, wouldn't that be the most sensible thing? Like, you know, they've proven that we can cope with the knowledge of that we're stuck here and this is all that there is, and not go crazy and kill ourselves, and, you know, have David Pilcher walking in the Remnants of the Town, which was clearly filmed after this this particular Remnants of the Town situation, because there was a car that it was exploded in at the end of A, and now there's a car that exploded for no apparent reason at the end of B. But that's okay. Hey, suspension of disbelief. Sure. Okay, whatever. But yeah, I think that's the plan. To slowly is this everybody? Okay, well, let's figure out how to save all of us.
Man, I wish Megan Fisher wasn't dead then, because she seemed to be the perfect person for orientation. Now they're going to have to bring in somebody else.
Well, at least they have the slideshow already
Hopefully.
Set up.
Hopefully. Who knows? Well, that's in the school where the arc is. So maybe,
oh, no. If they had just gone with the slideshow presentation and gone into the school, they would have discovered them instead of waiting for them to get ambushed or something.
Yeah. So maybe that's how the first generation got to the bunker. Was they like, some people decided to go for the PowerPoint presentation, and then the first generation took them hostage or something and made their way into the bunker. But we see an indeterminate amount of time pass. Ben wakes up in the hospital, basically in the same bed his father woke up in, and he is hovered over by a nurse, Amy, who is very weird, though she's not acting, you know, she's basically acting on the same level as she has the entire time, in my opinion. She's never not been weird, but she's in a nurse's outfit, and she basically, like, covers up a camera/monitor to talk about how she just reveals the truth right there and then. Ben has been, it's been three years and 4 months. Ben was put under with the rest of the adults that were in the bunker, our heroes, I guess I will say. And the first generation has inherited the Earth, as Jason predicted, and they decided to bring Ben out, though they are very wary of him, saying that they believe that Ethan was the one who took out the Savior, and that Ben's relation to him kind of gives him the mark of Cain. But Ben is sort of phased and simultaneously unfazed by this. Maybe that's just his expression. He just insists on his clothes and kind of stumbles out of the hospital.
Yeah, this made no sense. And I'm fine with you wanting to put a clever twist on it, M. Night, but it comes out of nowhere and it's not earned. And it doesn't make sense. I mean, Mr. Burke, well, look, they know who he is. It's the same people who put him to sleep, so they know it's Ben. You don't have to call him Mr. Burke. That right there, that's stupid. And like, they are listening. Who's listening? You know, the first generation is listening. You know, he knows who these people are. It's not the same mystery. It just, I don't know. It bothered me. It was done for the purpose of putting a twist ending on, and I just didn't need to be there.
Do you think the David Pilcher statue was in likeness to him, or do you think they embellished certain qualities of him to make him look a little less toad-like?
Yeah, I'm telling you, that metalsmithing class was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Why did they put that professor in storage? Because whoever was teaching him how to do it, I mean, that also, it's just like, come on, really?
There's a prodigy.
It didn't work.
I will say I was not as eagle-eyed the first time I watched the scene, because there was, you know, when Ben's walking through and it cuts, there's a shot that cuts to like a family with kids sitting there, which in the first place, you know, the thought of these people that young procreating and having children that young, it's basically like teen mom's greatest dream come true. But it's a little unnerving for me. I thought at first, when I saw that family, I thought it was the Fishers. And I was like, what? Why did that happen? And then like my mind was racing. I'm like, okay, I guess they wanted to keep Megan Fisher around because she liked them and her husband was with them. But then upon looking back, I was like, oh no, that's one of the many false alarms I had during the show. It was just a teen mom and her baby daddy.
Yeah, I mean, thank goodness that they didn't try to pull this whole, oh, you know, it was all just a dream thing or like
your much feared psychiatrist office ending.
Yeah, or you know that, oh, Mr. Burke. Yes, you're Ethan Burke. Like, no, they didn't go back. They didn't do any of that stuff. Thank goodness. That's what I was afraid of. But yeah, no.
Well, let's talk about the prospect of a season two here. Again, the prospect is very nigh, but we might as well talk about it just because we like to have fun here. AJ, can you think of a way to do season two that you would really enjoy if we're under the constructs here that, like, now this is about Ben navigating the world of the first generation populating Wayward Pines?
Okay, so I have to be able to enjoy it?
That's the caveat.
Okay, well, look, the good thing for the potential, if you're excited about this and you want to see season two, I mean, the fact that they've put all of the adults into Deep Freeze means they don't have to have Melissa Leo. They don't have to have Carla Gugino. They don't have to have any of the actors that were only signed on for one season. So they could totally do this just with Ben, Amy, and the rest of the kids. So, and since we didn't see most of the kids most of the season, it could be any CW cast-offs that they want to come here to Fox and put the show together. So it's actually more feasible, given this little tack on, that there will be a season two because of it. I think for me to watch, you'd have to recast Ben. But let's say you didn't do that. Ben has to kind of just be his father and kind of mirror that storyline where he's kind of like discovering that not everybody is happy here in Wayward Pines, mm-hmm. and discovering that there's probably some sort of group of people who are not necessarily behind all this. Maybe there's another Lot 37 somewhere, or another way into the mountain that they didn't know about, and that he can somehow go in there. At some point, you're going to have to defrost somebody that we recognize from season one, and perhaps that's the way you go about doing it. But it certainly is plausible that you could redo this season. It would have to be a little bit slower, and you'd have to take your time, and there wouldn't be this big reveal, but it would have to build, I would think, to at the very least getting either Pam or Kate there at the end of the season in your final episode.
I would, if I did a season two of Wayward Pines, I would actually adopt more of the go figure Lost model onto it, where we would, every episode, it would focus, or at least some of the action would focus on a different member of the first generation, and flashbacks will show what this kid's life and their parents' life was like in the previous generation of Wayward Pines. I think that would fill in a lot of the blanks in terms of, like, we don't know any of the first generation, including its de facto leader, Jason. Right. And we also don't know a lot about the adults of Wayward Pines and really what the environment was like outside of Ethan. And I'm always game for those stories, like those Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead-esque stories of, like, what the other people, the background characters, are doing while everything else is focused around the main characters. So I think that would be a fun thing to do, and I think it would really help the world building as well. But I'm totally with you on, like, I wouldn't say let's repeat beat for beat Ben wandering around
figuring out things in town,
but I think it would be nice to, like, see, have Ben start interacting with the first generation and realize the varying levels of how happy they are with the town, and maybe if they choose to plan an uprising against Jason, and, you know, now who's in the bunker, you know, is that a separate faction as well?
Sure, so, and at some point, like, you can incorporate the Hassler storyline from the book, and then he's made it back, and he's, you know, there is another civilization out there, or a plane flies overhead, and, like, everyone, like, goes, oh my goodness, someone else is alive, something. Where you can kind of expand the universe beyond Wayward Pines as well as exploring Wayward Pines itself.
Yeah. All right. AJ Mass, do you have any other things you'd like to bring up about both the finale of Wayward Pines or the season, possibly series as a whole?
I just think that, I admire the scope of the series, the attempt to really take a show that started as one thing and turn it into something else, and by the end it was a completely different thing than the middle. I appreciate the risk-taking that took. There was a lot of fun stuff in here. There was a lot of interesting stuff. I mean, we had questions, and we couldn't come up with the answer. And I don't think if you gave me a million tries, I would have come up with the, hey, it's 4,000-something, and there's these creatures out there. And, hey, you know, that was great. The truth was interesting and new and original. So as far as an experiment in television, I really did enjoy this series. In terms of being consistent plot-wise throughout and some of the acting, not so much. and you're going to get that with, you know, shows. I'm not in love with this, but it wasn't a piece of crap either. So I would say I hope every summer we have a show like this that is at least taking chances and trying to do something that isn't cookie cutter. and formula and something we've seen a million times before. And so for that sense alone, this gets a thumbs up as a series for me.
I would say this series, even in terms of like a meta narrative of TV culture as a whole, represents the effect of like cable's popularity now. I mean, let's look at like the Emmy nominations came out a few weeks ago, for instance, and there's no major nomination for any primetime cable show. A primetime, like, network show, I should say. And I think that's a sign to network shows of, like, people are enjoying much more of these Mad Men's and your Breaking Bad's and your Game of Thrones type of shows. And so I think this show is, like, an example of a network show trying to take a stab at something a little more out there, something you would see on a cable. And I, for one, am excited about that because, again, speaking towards the TV narrative in general, that shows at least a couple of executives are willing to take risks. And Fox, the network, is willing to take risks, which is what Fox is about. But it's an exciting prospect. I do agree that, like, I mean, there definitely were some not-so-great moments on this series. But again, I'll repeat my opinions. Overall, I definitely enjoyed this. It had so many tonal shifts that I have tonal whiplash at this point, but I still greatly enjoyed a lot of stuff that was going on. I thought the vast majority of the performances were fantastic, all things considered. You know, even when the scripts were not so good, these performances were actually great. Even someone like Matt Dillon, who I'm like in and out about in terms of performances sometimes, I thought he did a great job as Ethan. It was very well performed. It was a lot of fun to watch. Take or leave your writing holes, some stiff acting if you want to, but I'd say overall, entertained.
Yeah, and what, really, at the end of the day, isn't that what you want from a television show? Something that engages you for the time that it's on, makes you think a little bit about it after it's gone, you don't completely forget it and go, oh, what was that? It wasn't disposable, certainly.
Yeah.
We
want good TV.
Supposedly.
Well, if you guys want to supposedly check out some other great TV coverage here on Post-Show Recaps, we have it in droves. There is currently weekly coverage of True Detective going on here with Josh Wigler, Antonio Mazzaro, and Jeremiah Panhorst. They've been doing a great job with that. Otherwise, there's the Seinfeld recap with Akiva and Rob. That's always a lot of fun. Now that Seinfeld's on Hulu, you have no excuse not to binge the Hulu and subsequently binge the podcast. They're a lot of fun. And there's always stuff that's popping up here and there on Post-Show Recaps as well. AJ Mass, can you tell everyone where to find you on social media and also maybe some projects that you have just recently aired on the RHAP networks?
Yeah, well, you can always find me on the Twitter at AJ Mass, just six simple letters for a not-so-simple guy, at AJ Mass.
That's a great slogan.
I just came up with it now. What have I been doing? I've obviously done this. I also was on with our wonderful ambassador and leader, Rob Cesternino, and doing my Archetypes podcast for Big Brother, which came out earlier this week, and that is always a good listen. I particularly enjoyed this one, and we had a lot of fun trying to figure out which of the cast members, which of the house guests fit the archetypes. I think it was a fun ride, so please do take a listen if you haven't already.
Yeah, that was a really fun podcast. You can always find me at a Mike Bloom type on Twitter. I've been doing quite a bit on the RHAP networks these past couple weeks. If you haven't listened yet, our fearless leader, Rob Cesternino, and I have started our Survivor off-season coverage of the quote-unquote perfect Survivor season. We're basically taking the best Survivor episode 1, episode 2, etc., and trying to form this chimera of the perfect Survivor season. And we also, this past week, recapped the premiere episode of Last Comic Standing, which was a very, very fun podcast. Unfortunately, no weekly coverage this summer between all the other stuff we have going on, but still a lot of fun getting together with Rob. And over on reality TV, we're Hap Ups, which is the podcast to cover reality shows that Rob is not covering. I did a quick pitch hit here for Jessica Lease on the Amazing Race Canada Hap Up with the great Dan Keaton. We recorded our episode 3 podcast, which got released a couple days ago. It was a really fun episode, and there's going to be one coming up that I'm going to be covering as well. So there is so much going on to take you through the summer here, whether it's scripted or reality TV, we have you covered. To finish up our Wayward Pines coverage, AJ Mass, can we come up with a hashtag for people that have made it thus far?
Oh, I think the only hashtag we could possibly use for this is, of course, hashtag Thompson Hero.
Thompson Hero, as we eulogize the fantastic security guard that spoke up when he was supposed to and saved the day. We will always remember Thompson. even in cryogenic freezing. So hashtag Thompson Hero for making this far. A huge thanks to all of you that have come through all of the Wayward Pines coverage. This was a really fun show to cover. AJ, thank you. A big thanks to Kirk Clark as well for all the great work he's done as well. I'm sure this is not the last you'll be hearing from any of the three of us soon, but for now, take care.